concern that perhaps he may not be allowed to come in to Canada. And I'll tell you what happened. He explained to me. He said that this happened 36 years ago. He was in the Black Panther Party offices, and a American policeman came, and he obviously, there was, I'm sure you're aware that there was a program in the United States which was called COINTELPRO, Counterintelligence Program, which incidentally is still going on. I mean, if you want to read about it, there's actually a book called COINTELPRO. And this was deliberately a program set up by the FBI in order to target the Black Panther Party, in order to delegitimize them, because they were going around providing breakfast to disadvantaged children and doing all kinds of other social work. But they had to target them to eliminate them. So this police officer who came into their office, and he was assaulting an African-American sister. And so Phil, as an upright person, he stood up and he told the officer that you cannot do that. And of course, you know, a scuffle broke out. Not that he had assaulted the police officer, but you know the way the police works. They beat you up and they say, he assaulted me. So that's what happened to Phil. And of course, he was charged. And later on, the charge was dismissed in court. But unfortunately, you know, in the system that they have in North America, everything is integrated, so they have all the information about you. If you ever try to go to the U.S., you give them your name, and they know immediately who you are. They know everything, who your father is, your mother is, who your grandmother is, and where you were born, and where your great-grandfather was buried. They have all that information. So, you know, I mean, this is how, they call this a free society. I mean, this is how free it is. It's completely wired. So, of course, when they punched Phil's name, they found out that he had a conviction 36 years ago. Although that conviction was thrown out in court, and yet they said, well, you know, there is a conviction against you, so you have to come in for some questioning. And of course, he was bringing some books as well, his books, the book that he has written in defense of Iran. And for that, of course, you know, anytime you want to bring anything to Canada, the tax man wants his cut, you see. So he had to pay his tax, but the more serious issue was this aspect of this so-called conviction. But luckily, the officer who was dealing with this thing, he said, well, look, you know, I understand. This has been 36 years ago, and I believe what you say, that it's been thrown out. But you can see how tightly controlled the whole system is. So anyway, we are glad that Phil made it. He's been actually driving for 2 days. He set out last night from Richmond, Virginia. And you see, we are glad that he made it to Richmond Hill, Ontario. So he just arrived about, I guess, 7 o'clock or so at the hotel, quickly changed, and he got here. He hasn't even had dinner yet. But we are grateful that he decided to come here to share his thoughts with us. And after he speaks, of course, you know, we will have Cynthia speak to us. But in the meantime, Phil is going to share his thoughts. And also, as I mentioned, we have his book, In Defense of Iran, available here. The normal price is $18.95, but it'll be available for $10. I think it's a good bargain. You can take it, give it as gifts to somebody, and you know, you can get it, and perhaps, hopefully, Phil would be happy to autograph it for you. So would you please welcome Phil Vileto.
The last time I came up, there was no problem at all. I spoke over at Hamilton and McMaster, but this time, the fellow who, the first person I talked to, you know, as I'm trying to drive through, and he says, so where are you going? I'm saying, I'm going to Richmond Hill. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm giving a lecture. He said, on what? I said, of media relations. And he said, and where is the lecture going to be? And I said, at the Islamic Center of Metropolitan County of York. And he said, really? He said, why did they invite you to speak there? I mean, I'm in the car, you know, waiting to, everybody's piled up behind me. I said, well, I wrote a book. He said, on what? I said, on Iran. He said, what's the name of it? I says, it's In Defense of Iran, Notes from a U.S. Peace Delegation's Journey Through the Islamic Republic. And he looked at me. I said, I'm trying to stop a war. And he thought about that a second, then he said, good luck. So that was we got through that day. I did write a book. Several years ago, some Iranian-American friends of ours in Washington, D.C., convinced us that some of us in Richmond, Virginia, who belong to a community organization that's called the Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality, that's primarily African-American and works on issues dealing with jobs, housing discrimination, police brutality, and also war issues. We've always been involved in the anti-war movement. And a friend of ours who was Iranian-American said, you know, you should visit Iran. You know, all these terrible things are being said about Iran, and they want to start a war. You should go over there and see for yourself, and then come back and tell people. Well, I thought he was going with us. So we said, sure. So we recruited some people and, you know, did some fundraising. And at the last minute, Rostam said, no, he wasn't going at all. We were going by ourselves. So we went, and if people are familiar with Iran, you know, we had just a lovely time, embarrassingly beautiful time. It was almost like a vacation, and it was supposed to be this, you know, this journey through this, you know, foreboding, dangerous country, where everybody walks up to you and says, oh, how are you? Thank you for visiting Iran. We're not terrorists. And came back, and I actually did a lot of speaking engagements about my trip. You know, Iran from the point of view of an American, a U.S. citizen, and along with these Iranian-American friends who knew a great deal more about all of the technical issues and the political issues. And after a while, it started to sink in, and it seemed to be a good idea to write a book. I should point out that all the proceeds from the book go to support the work in Richmond. It's all volunteer, and so, you know, we're not going to get rich off of this. We're going to stay poor, as a matter of fact, but I think you might like the book. What I was asked to speak about tonight was media myths about Iran, and of course there are many. There's about five major ones that you can just guarantee will be brought up in almost any media representation. One is that Iran is supposedly run by a group of religious fanatics who are very dangerous, don't care about life, and wouldn't mind going to war. That they're trying to develop nuclear weapons, and if they did develop nuclear weapons, they would be likely to use them against Israel, which they supposedly have said should be wiped off the map. The president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is supposed to have said that there was no Holocaust, that Iranian government supports terrorism, and that it represses its own people. I think that's pretty much the package that comes out. And so the book tries to answer those questions. And I'm going to just, you know, we could spend hours and hours discussing those, but I'm going to hit those briefly. But I thought, you know, it would be remiss to go right to the subject of Iran without first mentioning the media and Egypt. Because I thought it was so fascinating over the last couple of days. I mean, we have the privilege of having, you know, the ability to watch on Al Jazeera and Press TV and other international sources a popular uprising that's unfolding before our very eyes of millions of people. Nothing like this has happened on this scale since the 1979 revolution in Iran. It's absolutely unbelievable. And what has been fascinating to me is watching how Washington has tried to deal with this. And as Washington tries to deal with this, how that effort is reflected in the news media. So first of all, supposedly out of nowhere, that's what they're saying. I'm not sure that's so true. I think they know that, you know, the people throughout the Arab world are unhappy with most of their rulers, and particularly those that are subservient to the U.S. That's a humiliating situation to be in, and then when you see the corruption and the arrogance and the poverty of the people, I think they must have some idea that people were not particularly happy. But when the demonstrations first started, they did seem to catch Washington a little off guard. And so, you know, there was a little bit of hesitation to characterize them one way or the other. When there were protests after the 2009 election in Iran, it didn't take 30 seconds for the United States to jump in and support politically. And when demonstrations happening on exactly the same issue broke out in Honduras to protest a U.S.-backed coup of a democratically elected progressive government, there was almost total silence. So you can usually tell who's good and who's bad by who Washington likes and doesn't like. I mean, it's a good rule of thumb to start off with. We're rarely cheering the same people and condemning the same people. So after the demonstration started to get a little momentum, quickly, and then they just exploded in size, and the president of Tunisia had already fled to Saudi Arabia. Then President Obama starts talking about the legitimate demands of the Egyptian people, and of course we are sympathetic with these demands and their cries for democracy and free elections. And it seems so ironic, since for 30 years the U.S. government has been propping up the dictator Hosni Mubarak by sending $1.5 billion a year to his military. Now, it's incredibly important because Egypt is the biggest, has the largest population of any Arab country. It has the largest military, was the first country to sign a peace treaty with Israel, and is the linchpin of U.S. Policy in dividing the Arab world in order to maintain its hegemony over the Middle East and its natural resources, which is the only real issue as far as the U.S. is concerned. They don't care about dictators. They don't care about Democrats. All they care about is the money. You know, you protect the money, you can be a Democrat, you can be a dictator, you can be Satan himself, it doesn't matter, as long as the profits flow to the U.S. corporations. But now they got a little problem, see, because everybody knows they were supporting Mubarak. So they've got to, Mubarak should go, sort of, at some point. Maybe, so long as there is a peaceful, structured, orderly transition to the new democracy. In other words, so long as we can control it. That's the issue, see? And while they're trying to figure out what to do, the Army's trying to figure out what's going to do too, The Army, if Mubarak gets overthrown, we want to be on the winning side. There's a lot of talk about Egyptian army being unique and part of the people and defending the sovereignty, and there is a particular history there. But it's also the army that enforces the blockade against Gaza. It's also the army that withdrew itself from conflicts, with any potential conflicts with Israel. It's an army that basically has supported the regime, but not so much that it wants to go down with it. So as the movement shift and changed, the media shift and changed. 4 or 5 days, 6 days into the uprisings, the Egyptian people were the heroes of the world. They're fighters for democracy, and they're standing there up against the terror of the police, and that's wonderful. And then Mubarak doesn't go, and the demonstrations become larger. And then the workers start to go out on strike, and the service workers on the Suez Canal start to go on strike, and the next step might be that the Suez workers who run the canal might go on a strike, and then it's not so fun anymore. And then we're talking about the possibility of chaos and anarchy in the streets, and a little bit of peaceful protest is all fine and good, but, don't go any further, because we got to have a structured, rational transition to democracy that we can control. So with every twist and turn of the struggle, the U.S. government adopted a slightly different stance, and that was reflected almost immediate in the news media. And now they're not quite sure what to do. I mean, they can't condemn everything that they've supported over the last 30 years. They can't endorse a popular uprising. And they're really worried that there may not be this peaceful transition. So it's still very much an unfolding situation. And we can only hope that that the Egyptian people will continue to show the courage, the resiliency, the intelligence, the strategy, the organizing skills that they have shown up to this point, and that they eventually will be successful, not only in changing the faces in government, but in changing that government itself. Now about Iran. When we first went over to Iran, the first time, I was able to go this past August and spend about 3 weeks there, and that was even a more interesting visit in some ways. But the first thing you notice as an outsider, as a quote-unquote American, when Americans go from the North Pole to the South Pole, so I don't like to use that word, but I don't like United Stater either. It just doesn't have that. So as a U.S. American is what I've come to settle on. It was interesting going there because the Iranian people really do like people from the United States. I still can't figure it out, given the history and so on. But I think part of it has to do with they draw a distinction between the government and the people. And they also, they're so proud of their own history, 8,000-year-old history, and that's contributed so much to the world. And they know they're viewed in a very terrible, negative way by the West. And they really want to convince you that it's not true. And then, of course, there's just a long history, you know, of hospitality in a country that is crisscrossed by caravan trades and has always consciously played a role of people who extend hospitality to strangers and travelers. This is part of the culture. So, when we went over there, we thought, well, okay, we're not gonna touch the issue of the government. That's not you know what we're going there for. We're going there, number one, to show you can go there, because so many people were afraid, you know, to go to Iran, and we weren't just going to Tehran. We were going to take a van trip around the country, from Shiraz and Yazd and Esfahan and Homs. It was about 1,350 miles altogether. On the van, a little bit on the air. And we didn't believe that it was the way we were told it. We didn't believe it was that dangerous. We believed that, you know, what our Iranian American friends told us, that we'd have a wonderful experience. And we did. The second thing we wanted to do was to express to as many Iranians as we could the desire of the American people to have peace with the world. I'm not going to say there's a sense of solidarity. That would be going way too far, and I think we have to look reality in the face. People in the United States don't get information that's accurate, and if they did, I think their basic goodness would come through. What they get is a lot of lies and an attempt to make them afraid of everyone in the world. They're even a little bit nervous about Canadians. But, so that was a second reason, to extend a hand of friendship and peace to the Iranian people and to try to bring back what we knew would be their gestures to the U.S. And the third was just to poke a finger in the eye of George Bush and Dick Cheney. And because they're advising people, you know, they're advising U.S. citizens not to go to Iran, and if you did, you should register with the State Department. And so I registered for the draft when I was 18, and that was all the registration I want to do with the U.S. government. So we went, and one of the things we found out was some of the things that the Iranian government does for the people. The philosophy of the government appears to be a concern for the poor. Now, the Iranian government isn't monolithic. There are people in many different factions, many different organizations, many different points of view. There are those who really do favor the privatization of the economy, and there are those who are fighting very hard against that. There are those who think that programs of social welfare are treating people, teaching them to have a victimization mentality. I think those of us in the U.S. know that is the Republican line about social programs. And there are those who feel that the wealth of the country should be used to benefit primarily those who have been denied an opportunity to earn a decent living and care for their families and so on. So I started becoming a little more sympathetic to the government. And as time went on, I became more sympathetic. And began to see that even at that point in 2007, I would meet people who were critical of the government, and I all of their criticisms were not invalid. There's much progress that needs to be made in Iran, as there is in any country. It's probably the most democratic country in the entire Middle East. But there are things that could be improved. But I noticed that the people who were most hostile to the government were the ones who were the most better off. There's an issue of class. And they also tend to be much more sympathetic to the role that the U.S. government is playing in the world, and much less hostile to Israel, and much less concerned about the plight of the Palestinians. That's painting it with a very, very broad brush. But as a general rule, I think that is true. And one of the things I've been criticized for a lot by right-wing Iranian Americans is suggesting that the Iranian government is legitimate. That not only was the election in 2009 legitimate, we could talk all about the reasons why I think that, and I wrote a pamphlet about it. You're welcome to check that out also. But, you know, two-thirds of the people are working class and poor, and maybe one-third is middle class, and the vote broke down one-third to two-thirds. And when people say, you know, the Iranian people rose up and condemned the election, well, some of the Iranian people did. But not everybody in Iran is a yuppie. That's not true. There's a lot of working class people, a lot of poor people that have benefited from the revolution. So that gets into the question of a government that represses its own people. Also gets into the question of a government that supposedly is run by religious fanatics who don't care about the here and now because they only focused on the future. Well, I mean, Jesus Christ fed the multitudes with loaves and fishes. He didn't say, you know, don't worry about it because someday you're going to die and go to heaven. He was concerned about the welfare of poor people, those who don't have things, don't have enough to eat. And I saw far more concern for the poor and disenfranchised in Iran than I've ever seen from my own government in the United States. But what about the number one issue? The number one issue, which is that Iran is trying to develop nuclear weapons. And this is the charge that is made over and over and over again, even though there is not one scintilla of evidence that it's true. Not from the United Nations inspection team with the International Atomic Energy Agency, not with the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, not from the Israeli Mossad. No one has been able to come up with any bit of evidence that Iran is actually trying to develop nuclear weapons. It has a program to develop nuclear power for peaceful energy purposes. They told me I don't get chicken tonight if I speak too long, so I just wanted to double check. No, I'm kidding. Sorry. Iran has the right to develop nuclear energy for peaceful energy purposes. It signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty of the United Nations, which states that if a country does not have nuclear weapons and promises not to develop it, It not only will be recognized as having the right to develop nuclear power for electricity purposes, but it will receive assistance from those countries that already have that power, already have that expertise. So under this treaty that the vast majority of countries in the world have signed, Iran has the right not only to develop nuclear power, but to say to the United States, hey, give us a hand here, help us put this thing together. But instead, the U.S. government states that, well, yeah, you have a right to develop nuclear power. Secretary of State Clinton has stated that several times. But we think that you're just using that program as a cover to develop nuclear weapons. Well, how can Iran prove that it isn't doing that? You can't prove a negative. You know, you can't prove that I'm not planning tonight to rob three banks on my way back to Virginia. I can tell you I'm not, but they go, yeah, but you know, you're going to pass a lot of banks on the way home. And, you know, You know, it's a possibility. You know, what's the matter? You don't want money? Oh, I wouldn't mind having money, but I'm not going to rob a bank for it. Well, that's what you say. But, you know, you're a nut. You know, that's what they do. Of course Iran wants to develop nuclear weapons. Number one, they have a fanatically dangerous government. And number two, they want to destroy Israel. It doesn't, well, if they're so fanatically religious, then how come when Ayatollah Khomeini issues a fatwa saying it would be a sin against Islam to develop nuclear weapons, that the West doesn't mention it and doesn't take it seriously? And when I tell that to audiences in the West, they go, yeah, well, you know, of course they're going to say that. All right, that's a valid argument. They could just be saying that. But during the eight-year war between Iraq and Iran, when Saddam used chemical and biological warfare against the Iranian soldiers and people and carried out mass aerial bombings of Iranian cities, and members of the military who had served under the Shah came to Ayatollah Khomeini and said, we want to respond likewise, he said, no. You can't do that. That would be against Islam. That's a weapon of mass destruction, and you can't do it. And he issued a fatwa against it, and the United Nations inspection teams say that Iran never responded in kind, despite losing 600,000 or more people. You can't have it both ways. I better brush up on my Arabic before I make another remark like that. So you can't have it both ways. You know, either they're religious or they're not religious. You know, and so for, you know, other countries have come forward, the non-aligned movement, the Organization of Islamic Countries. Some 70% of all countries in the world have gone on record as stating that Iran does have the right to develop nuclear power for peaceful energy purposes. But yet it has been hit with round after round after round of sanctions. It's the one thing that scares people in the United States the most, and they're going to keep that up until they think that they can undermine the government by imposing sanctions that will hurt the average person and cause them to rise up against the Islamic government in Iran. I don't think that's going to happen. I know this is not Egypt. You know, people say, you know, there's all these arguments now about, you know, why didn't it happen in Iran like it's happening in Egypt? Well, for one thing, the leadership in Iran are not subservient, craven puppets of U.S. imperialism. They defy U.S. imperialism. As a matter of fact, there's no one in the Green Movement that denies that Iran has the right to develop nuclear power. No one is calling for Iran to surrender in that score. No one is calling for sanctions on the higher levels of the Green Movement. And no one is certainly calling for an invasion. So it's there are class differences, there are questions of different views on how politics should be carried out, and there are abuses that have taken place in Iran that fortunately major figures in the government have acknowledged and tried to address, but it's a struggle. You know, I don't like to paint a picture like everything is perfect. No, nothing's perfect everywhere, and things are not perfect in Iran. They're better than they are in most other countries in the Middle East, and for a poor person is better off in Iran than they are in the United States. That is true. That is true. I happen to be one of those 50 million people who don't have health insurance. You know, the poverty level in Richmond, Virginia, which is a majority black city, is 25.7%. 25.7%. The unemployment rate is only 7.5%, which tells you there's a lot of people working and making wages that don't lift them out of poverty. How about supporting terrorism? One person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. That's a truism. I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, where there's monuments all over the state to the farmers who used to keep their guns close by so that when they got the call, they would rush out in the woods and hide behind trees and shoot the British troops as they rode by. And, of course, the British regarded them as, you know, whatever word they used that would be the equivalent of terrorists. I put it in my book that the British regarded them as terrorists, and my mother called called me on it. She said, they didn't use that word back then. Well, she's right. She's kind of a self-made historian. So she gave me a lot of good advice on the book. But Iran doesn't support Al-Qaeda. They're sworn enemies. Iran helped the U.S. get the Taliban out of Afghanistan. Got very little credit for it, but played that role. But when a people rise up against oppression, when Israel invades a country and thinks it can take it over, take advantage of the fact that there's a weak government there, and a popular resistance movement rises up and drives them back out of the country, that's not terrorism. That's not terrorism. And when construction companies move into your neighborhood and start kicking you out of your homes and tearing your ancestral homes down and building condos for settlers from Brooklyn, New York, and people rise up to try to drive them out, that's not terrorism either. That's resistance. That's resistance. And Iran supports resistance against oppression. So they support Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they support Hamas in Gaza. And interestingly enough, Hezbollah is Shia, and Hamas is Sunni. It's not based on religion. It's based on an opposition to oppression. I'm trying to keep an eye on the clock here, so I've got to wrap this up. So the issue of Israel is a little easier to explain, I think, if you can just talk to people about it. Iran is not an anti-Semitic country. It doesn't have an anti-Semitic government. In fact, it has the largest Jewish community in the Middle East outside of Israel. Some 30,000 people, and then they've been there a lot longer than Zionism has been around. And there's 11 functioning synagogues in Tel Aviv, and kosher shops, meat shops, and a Jewish hospital, and there's they're building a cultural and sports center at government expense that the Jewish community asked for. But they're opposed to Israel. They're opposed to Israel. So you have to understand that Zionism doesn't represent all Jews, and opposition to Zionism doesn't mean you're opposite to Jews. And the best way that people will learn that lesson is as more and more Jewish people stand up against Zionism, which is happening, which is happening. And President Ahmadinejad did not deny the Holocaust. On the quote about wiping Israel off the map, it was a mistranslation. And anybody who knows Farsi can just say that this regime, as the Imam said, this regime occupying Jerusalem will disappear from the pages of history. He wasn't calling for the physical disruption. And finally, Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez from the U.S. Progressive television program Democracy Now! Interviewed President Ahmadinejad and asked him straight out. He said, do you believe that the Nazis killed millions of Jews? And he says, of course. Of course. That's a fact, a historical fact. But that happened in Europe. That was Europeans killing Europeans on European soil. How does that justify taking land away from the Palestinians in the Middle East to build a Jewish state? That's what he asked. See? And when he talks about the mythology of the Holocaust, I don't believe he's saying that the Holocaust is a myth. He's saying that what happened to 6 million Jews has been raised to the level of a myth in order to justify the establishment of Israel. And then the fact that there were many millions more who were killed by the Nazis, Roma people, trade unionists, homosexuals, communists, people with mental disabilities, some say as many as 5 million more. Why are they not mentioned as part of the Holocaust? You know, we should be as outraged about one person being murdered and the target of genocide as anyone else. And that is what I think Iran stands for. It's against the oppression of any people, including the Palestinians. That's some of the answers to the media myths. There's a new one that pops up every day, and for a while I was trying to stay on top of, you know, every report that was coming out of Iran about this person being arrested and mistreated for simply, you know, demanding their rights. And most of the time when I was able to look into it, there were some problems with the story. When I was in Iran in last August, the situation of the three U.S. hikers was very on the front burner. And I was getting emails from friends at home in the peace movement saying, Phil, can you try to get the hikers released? You know, yeah, sure, I'll make a couple of calls, you know. but as it turns out, I met somebody who met somebody who met somebody, and I got introduced to some very interesting people, one of them who is very close to the president. And on the last day before I was going home, I said, you know, I've been getting these emails and so on. I wish I had maybe been able to visit the hikers in the prison, in even prison, so I could tell what the situation was. And she said, why didn't you ask me before? Happened to be the widow of Dr. Fatemi, who was the foreign minister under Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, who was overthrown by the CIA. And Dr. Fatemi is one of the most well-respected individuals in all of Iran. When she's in Iran, she stays at the Hotel Leila, which is on Dr. Fatemi Street. And she pulled a few strings, and she came back, you know, that night, and she said, if you want to go to even prison, you can visit the young woman, Sarah Sloan, was the person who they were saying was suffering from cancer, and that was most of the attention. So I thought about it, and I said, you know, if I do that, they're going to say, hey, this guy who's sympathetic to the Iranian government says everything's fine. That's not going to carry much weight. But how about if I come home and talk to her mother? Could I get a visa to bring her mother back so we could go visit Sarah together? And they said, yes. I got permission to do that. So I came home, and we reached it through friends in the peace movement. We reached Sarah Sloan, the mother, and she was ecstatic. And she said, I just got to run it by the other mothers because we try to do everything together, but let's go, let's do a mixture of like 10 days to a week. We'll go back. Next day, I get an email saying that she had discussed it with the other mothers, and they decided this would not be a good idea, that it would just be a propaganda coup for the Iranian government and might make it more difficult to get the kids out. Well, I know what happened. She talked to the State Department. She'd already met twice with Hillary Clinton, and it was a lot better to have a white woman supposedly suffering from cancer, suffering in even prison, than it would be to bring her home. When she did come home, she got a physical examination at Qatar, and there was nothing wrong with her. She was in fine physical shape. I'm not saying the case was handled correctly in Iran. All I'm saying is that if an American stubs their toe in Tehran, it's going to be an international incident. And we should be very, very cautious about how we view these things. There's lots more I'd love to say. It's time for me to get off the stage. I hate it particularly when white guys talk so long. And I'm up here with a representative of the Cuban government and one of the most well-known heroes of the U.S. progressive movement, Cynthia Kinney. So I think the better part of modesty is to sit down. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. One question that was asked was about the rise of the right in the West, and at a time when people throughout the Middle East are coming out on the streets demanding justice and a progressive government, and people in Latin America are adopting socialism instead of colonialism. What is going on in the U.S. and the United Kingdom and some other countries? And in Richmond, I live in the state of Virginia, which has a reputation as being a conservative state, although it voted for Barack Obama in the last election. It's the first time they elected a Democrat since Lyndon Johnson. And I'm not using, you know, President Obama as a litmus test for progressive votes, but they voted for him rather than John McCain. So that was interesting. And even today, the polls say that if President Obama were to run today, he would carry Virginia again by a very small margin. Now, that's not the impression you get in Virginia, because Virginia has one of the largest Tea Party movements in the country. They had a statewide convention last October in Richmond, and they claimed that 2,800 people came. And that was three or four times the largest any number of people that turned out for a statewide convention. So I attended the convention. I'd previously gone to a Tea Party rally because if we're going to face fascism, I want to know about it early on, because there's steps you have to take to defend yourself and your movement. And they had pulled out 3,000 people in a rally about a year ago in Richmond. And I noticed that while the speakers were talking about immigration and about the Constitution and about all of these, you know, their standard, there were signs demanding jobs and then into foreclosures. This is a white movement. It's people have described it as a white nationalist movement. It's a movement of the white middle class that is frightened, that it's lost its position, which it never questioned before. It never questioned before. I just bought a GPS. I usually use the Google Maps, and I ran out the route from Richmond, Virginia to Richmond Hill, and it was four pages. Every 10 miles you have to turn. So I finally said, I can't do this anymore. I travel a lot, and I have a terrible sense of direction. So I bought a GPS. So for the GPS, you have several choices of voices that you can use. And there are three white women, there is one white man, and then if you want to go to French, there's a French woman and a French man who are, you know, ethnically French. And then there's, if you want to go to Spanish, there's a woman and a man who, I used to know a little Spanish, and it's more Castilian, in other words, from Europe rather than Latin America. So in other words, when you move to a new level of technology, all of the talk about a new, you know, diverse society and racial tolerance and, you know, a post-racial society goes out the window. The default is white. When they opened clip art, remember clip art, for those of those of you who are older, and you could download images from computers, and everyone was white except Martin Luther King. They always had Martin Luther King, but everybody else was white. And when they started, you know, moving away from real operators and getting someone, you pick up a phone and it says, "Thank you for calling our company," and their call is very important to us. It's always a white person. Well, that was the mindset. And now, you know, in 40 years, white people will be a minority in the United States. They're already a minority in California and Texas. And it's very, very unsettling to a lot of white folks. Now, a lot of white folks voted for Barack Obama, which is interesting, because to vote for, you know, the most valuable player in the NFL is one thing. But to vote for the guy who's going to sit in the White House, control over your life, you have to think he's intelligent. And for white people to think that a black person is more intelligent than they are is a fundamental undermining of white supremacy. It's very important. It's a very important cultural change. So what we have in the country is one group of white people who are willing to say, I'd like to put a black man in the White House. And another group of white people who said, holy moly, that's the end of the world. You know? So we have a division, a split. I don't think it's that the right wing represents the majority of people. I think when you look at who, as Cynthia McKinney pointed out, who's funding? She asked who's funding the progressives. Who's funding the right wing? See, it's the corporations. It's the corporations that fund foundations that then give money to nonprofits, which then give money to the Tea Party. Even so, they pulled out a rally to influence the General Assembly in Richmond a couple of weeks ago. It was only 200 people. We pulled out one that had 110 people. You can count when there's only 110. So they only pulled out twice as many as we did with all the resources they have behind them. So I think we have to worry about the right wing, particularly because of a fear of economic ruin of the white middle class, coupled with scapegoating immigrants and people of color, coupled with a militaristic tendency towards violence, are the three ingredients that will give you a genuine fascist movement. And I don't think that's a word we should throw around easily, because you have to fight fascism with violence. You can't fight fascism with nonviolence. We're not there yet in the United States, in the country as a whole. Certain sections, we're pretty close. But we're much closer to a police state than we are to a fascist state. So I don't think we should feel that the U.S. has just gone to the right and that it's hopeless. It's split down the middle. That's the problem. And what we need is a credible alternative, not only among the people of color who are more open to a progressive agenda and on the domestic issues and the international issues, but we need a movement that also says to the white workers, you know, the Tea Party can't open up a single factory that shut down. They can't give you a single job. They can't make sure your kids go to college. All they can find is someone to blame it on. Join with us. Join with your sisters and brothers in the Black, Latino, Asian, Native American, Middle Eastern communities. Defend the Islamic community. Demand the U.S. get out of the 160 countries where it has troops. Come over to a progressive agenda. That's the only way that you can improve your life and feel good about yourself in a real sense.